Hi, everybody, and welcome back to Shuttle Pod, the Trek Movie Podcast. I'm Brian Drew. I've been with Trek Movie now, I guess, about two and a half years. And joining me on this podcast is Kayla.
Hi there. My name is Kayla. I think I've been working for Trek Movie, geez, since 2007. So it doesn't seem like that long, but I guess it's been like 8 years.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow.
That's long enough for another full-length Trek series to have come and gone.
Yeah, actually, wow, that's a good point. That's true. Never thought of it. That is more than a Trek series long.
Seriously. Trek Movie. My name is Jared. I've been with Trek Movie about 2 years. I think my first article was September 2013, so just a little over 2 years. And we are delighted to be able to do the Shuttle Pod. I hope our fans out there in Trek Nation enjoyed as much as we do. The three of us all live relatively far away from each other, and so normally we only get to hang out in Las Vegas at the convention there every August. And so to be able to do this with you guys every couple weeks is fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah, I look forward to this, absolutely. And we hope you folks at home enjoy it as well.
Yeah, if our internal polling data is accurate at all, you're probably listening to this on your phone on the toilet, so we hope that you are quite literally going where no man has gone before. Anyway, sorry.
Ba-doom boom.
Ba-doom boom.
So we thought before the year ends that we would discuss Voyager and its 20th anniversary. Voyager premiered, actually, in January of 1995. So it's, you know, we're coming up on the 21st anniversary, but we figured we'd get this in under the wire. And, you know, we thought we would mark the anniversary on the podcast and, you know, reflect back on the show and our initial feelings about it when it premiered and what we feel it got right, what we feel it didn't do as well as it possibly could have. So I guess I'd like to lead this off by asking both of you what your initial reaction was when you saw the pilot.
So I remember very, very vividly that Voyager coming on the air and the anticipation ahead of time. And my grandmother, who was not a Trek fan, she was so keyed into the anticipation on it that she was sure to save her TV guides that you know, were leading up to Voyager and had the promotional material for them and give them to me so I'd have them because she knew I was so excited for it. And I remember just thinking, this is going to be fantastic. This is going to be so great. And the pilot, I don't think in terms of, you know, now that we look at it back, I don't think the pilot holds up as well as the Deep Space Nine pilot, but it's definitely better than Encounter at 4 Point.
Yeah.
When Voyager first came out, I mean, I was really excited about the idea that we were going to finally have a female captain. And regardless of, you know, whether we could argue as to whether Janeway was the best female captain we could have had or whether or not Mulgrew did well with that role or whether or not the writers did well with her character, the fact that we had that person in that role, we had a woman in, you know, leading the ship, is one of the things that really kept me coming back. Mm-hmm. And I think it's still remembered as a show that is going to, that is leading the way for women at the time in television because they did have a woman at the helm, not to mention other strong female characters in the show as well. So for me, I mean, that was a big part of what kept me coming back to it.
I remember seeing an interview once with some fans at a convention, and this was in the late 90s or something, and it was all these women, and they're saying that they were so glad that there was a role model, a woman in authority on TV for their daughters to see, who was not, and this is the quote I remember quite vividly, a witch with a B at the front.
Huh.
which I thought they avoided with Janeway very well. She, I think, and certainly you see those, the test footage with the original actress, Genevieve Bujold, I want to say.
Genevieve Bujold.
Thank you, thank you. And I think Kate Mulgrew did an excellent job with the role.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do too.
It would have been interesting to see Genevieve's take on it, though, beyond, you know, those little scraps of footage that we've all seen.
Yeah, yeah, because we don't have a season of her. We only have a few scenes of her.
Well, it's
her,
like the road not taken. It's almost like the road not taken. You know what I mean? Just out of curiosity, the what if? You know, what would Voyager have been? I don't know if it would have made any difference at all, but just out of curiosity.
Yeah, it might not.
My initial reaction to the show, I was anticipating it. I thought the premise was a really cool notion, you know, sending a Starfleet ship way out far beyond Federation space and seeing how they would respond. And, you know, it would allow them to basically unshackle themselves from Star Trek canon because they were going to be so far away from everything that they could basically have an empty slate.
Yeah.
And I thought that would have been really cool. And having Janeway be having a female captain was cool. Like, the whole idea behind Voyager when it was announced was really cool. And, you know, they were building these new sets and giving everything kind of a fresh new look. And I was really excited about it. But I got to be honest, yeah, the pilot for the show, I could kind of take it or leave it. It kind of leaves me, to this day, kind of leaves me kind of cold. I don't know.
So something that, and maybe it's related to the subject of the female captain, when I recently rewatched some scenes from Caretaker, I feel like the main character that they're setting up is not Janeway. I feel like the main character of Caretaker is Tom Paris. Mm-hmm. Because we have that big opening action sequence with Tuvok and Chakotay and B'Elanna where they get swept up in the Badlands, I think it was called. And then it cuts, and our first real scene of the series is Janeway coming to liberate Tom from this penal colony's in, and we learn all about his backstory. And of course, because he played Nick Locarno a couple years earlier on TNG, he was someone who's a little more familiar to audiences. And I feel like at that point, everything is through the prism of Tom Paris. We introduce Harry Kim, and it's through his relationship with Paris that's sort of the interesting part. Like, he's being hoodwinked by Quark, and Tom comes and saves him, and then some of the senior officers say, oh, you stay away from that Tom Paris kid. And when we eventually meet up with the Maquis characters, we learn that there's this animosity between Tom and Chakotay, and then Tom in the end actually ends up saving Chakotay's life, so they become friends. And so even though they wanted to do the female captain, I think they couldn't move away psychologically from the idea of having this kind of, if Riker was kind of a younger version of Kirk, then Tom Paris is maybe kind of a younger version of Riker. They couldn't move away from that kind of dashing alpha male type, maybe.
Yeah, the archetype, yeah.
Archetype, yeah. I don't know. Taylor, what do you think about that?
Yeah, no, I've heard you allude to this theory before about Tom Paris being the main character. And I kind of agree with you, especially when it comes to the pilot. It's, and like you said, that scene where, you know, they're getting Tom out of the penal colony or whatever. It really seems like you want to learn more about this character. You want to learn more about him, and he has such a rich backstory. Uh-huh. Just like, how did he get in the penal colony? And you have all these questions about him, and it's like all focused on him. And I feel like whenever I'm watching it, I always feel like they're trying to do the, you know, let's get the band together kind of a setup for the show of like, we're going to go get this person and then this person and then this person. And they kind of do, but somehow Tom seems to be, I think it even has like, I feel like it has the most airtime just in my memory. It seems like his story was highlighted the most of all the people who were coming to the ship. So if they had given like equal airtime to all the other people coming to the ship, maybe it would have made more sense. But I guess like throughout the rest of the show, I don't know. I'd have to see more examples, I guess, throughout the show to decide whether I thought that was true of the show as a whole. So I think they did a lot of stories focused on other people where Tom Paris wasn't, you know, necessarily a pivotal part of the story. So I don't know. That's just, like, I definitely agree with you the way it was set up. It seems like they were setting him up to be the guy that we were, that he was meant to guide us through the world of that Voyager was going to be.
Right. And he was a flawed character and we were going to see him grow.
Exactly, sure. Yeah. And we could relate to him.
Which, to be fair, I think is one of the strongest suits of the series. And there's this great line that Tom has in the finale where Harry's talking about, he's talking to Tom and he says, well, don't you finally want to get home? And Tom says, Harry, I am home. And I kind of wanted that to be like the final message of the show, is like they never get home, but they don't need to. And so, we jumped from the opening to the finale, but I thought that was a better sentiment. It may have been more interesting to just leave them stranded. Although I can understand why they didn't.
Yeah, I think that's one of those things, like, you know, ending a show, it's hard. It's impossible to please everyone.
Sure.
And I mean, this is one of the shows where you had two possible outcomes. Either they get home or they don't. So I think you can make arguments for both. But yeah, that would have been, that was one of the moments where you're like waiting for someone to say that, you know, to say, oh, I am home, this is my family, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And then he did put it into words, which was really nice.
So something that I want to say while we're talking about in terms of who the main character was going on, I actually did a statistical analysis based on Voyager summaries on Wikipedia. If you look at the Wikipedia page for a list of Star Trek Voyager episodes, they'll list like the title, the director, the writer, and then who the main focus is of the episode. And it can sometimes be more than one character, so it might be B'Elanna and Tom if it's an episode that's heavy about their relationship. And so I took all that and I put it into a spreadsheet. It only took about 15 minutes. It wasn't very long. And I wanted to share some data with you and with the audience about what percentage of the time a character's name appeared as being the featured character of that episode. And of course, this isn't scientific. This is just from Wikipedia or whatever, anecdotal. But it's kind of telling. The number one appearance is Various, right? 35.5% of the episodes have Various listed as the people who are starring,
Does it list who the people are, or just as Various?
Various means that there were, I think, four or more who were focused, or that it was an ensemble piece. And so I think that speaks very strongly to the show that they had such a strong ensemble. But then after that, in terms of individual characters, guess who the one is who had the most episodes focused on him?
I'm going to guess, since you're bringing it up, that it's Tom Paris?
No, it isn't. It is not. Oh. It's not actually wrong on this. It's actually the Doctor. The Doctor appeared on almost 12% of those entries as one of the featured characters. Huh. And then after the Doctor, it's B'Elanna Torres, which really surprised me, at 10.5% of the time. And then after that, it was Seven of Nine at 8.7% of the time, which is not surprising, because once she's introduced, she kind of takes over the series.
Yeah.
But considering that she wasn't on for half the show, that it's only 8.7 is kind of interesting, because she's only there for... Yeah. And then after that, it's Tom Paris at 7.6% of the time. And then Tuvok and Janeway are tied at 7%.
Wow.
And then Chakotay... Yeah, that really surprised me that Janeway was so low.
Then
Chakotay is 6%, Harry is 5%, Neelix is 4%, and Kes is 3.5%.
And so when you say, like, oh, Janeway is this percent, are you including episodes that were, say, Janeway and Chakotay?
Exactly,
That counts towards her and towards his? Okay.
Uh-huh, exactly. So if you added up all these, it would be higher than 100%, because, you know, most of the episodes featured two characters or whatever.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Anyway, wow, from that standpoint, it's kind of hard to say that Janeway was the main character,
But certainly the Doctor wasn't the main character.
Oh, no, most definitely not.
I don't know.
Very popular.
Very popular, and I think Robert Picardo is probably the best actor in the group, so it makes sense that he got a lot of attention thrown his way.
That I would agree with.
Yeah, and so it kind of makes sense that he would steal some thunder. Oh, and then another thing that I just remember talking about him is when the Doctor appears, who is assigned to be his nurse at the very beginning, but Tom Paris.
Oh,
so,
right, of course.
So every character has some kind of connection to him.
That's right.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that was
even
something. That's right. And then they did like the love triangle with Neelix and Kes and Tom, which just felt weird on all fronts.
Yeah, that was so awkward.
Yeah.
I think the Neelix and Kes, I always thought that relationship was weird. I didn't think they ever kind of fit together.
No, I mean, Neelix, I'm not the first one to say it. He's kind of been regarded as the Jar Jar Binks of the Star Trek universe for, you know... I mean, I'm sure he has his defenders, and I'm sure Ethan Phillips is a great guy, and he's always really funny at the conventions. But I think that they wanted someone to bring as much to their series as Quark was bringing to Deep Space Nine, but they weren't willing to make him as a potentially miscreant of a character, because they wanted him to be cute and cuddly, and so it just never quite worked, in my opinion.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I kind of liked Neelix. Like, I don't know if I would defend him necessarily, but he seems like a sweet guy. Like, he seems like a genuine person. I think Ethan Phillips, like, did really well with the role as it was written. But I just felt like, because Kes was what, like, her race only lived to be, what, like, 9 years old? So when we meet her, she's, like, 2.
Mm-hmm.
And then here's this dude who's, like, I don't know, almost middle-aged, maybe? It's hard to tell. And he's, like, dating this person who's, like, obviously more mature than, like, an infant, but still, she's 2 years old, and, like, and she acts young, you know?
Yeah.
And innocent.
And she looks very young.
And she looks young, and he's obviously, even all other things being equal, adjusting for the life cycle differences, like, she still feels too young for him, to right. me. And it's kind of creepy. It seems like, I don't know, when we first meet him, it's like he's taking advantage of her almost.
Yeah. Yeah, that was the phrase that I was thinking in my mind, is that he's taking advantage of her. You know, and with the idea of him, like, well, I mean, if we want to make a comparison in pop culture, you know, the Doctor on Doctor Who is, like, massively older than his young female companions, and he's taking them around the universe for the first time. But that never feels creepy. It always feels like the Doctor is a fun uncle or even a grandfatherly type figure. Right. But when it's explicitly stated that Neelix is in a romantic relationship with Kes, then it kind of seems a little weird.
Yeah.
Okay. I agree. In terms of other characters in the rest of Voyager, I have a very fond place in my heart for Tuvok. I think that Tim Russ had some very big shoes, or if you will, ears to fill, and I think he did a magnificent job. I don't know if you guys disagree, but I always loved the Tuvok heavy episodes and Tuvok scenes. There's this one episode, I'm sure some of our fans will be able to comment on it and remind me what it is, where Janeway is just, you know, really upset with everyone in her crew. They're not doing what they're supposed to. They're showing up late for their duties. She's like, we need to start, you know, cutting down their holodeck times and restricting some of their privileges. And she's really going off the handle. And Tuvok, with as much sarcasm as a Vulcan can have, he says, "Shall I have them flogged as well, Captain?" And just that little bit of Vulcan sarcasm kind of makes her realize that she needs to tone down a little bit. And I just thought it was magnificent. It's exactly what they needed a Vulcan to do.
That is a great line of his. I don't know. I like the Tuvok character, although he's not my favorite Vulcan. I think I've never encountered a Vulcan as much that I liked as much as Spock.
Sure.
And I know that's again, like you say, big ears to fill.
Yeah.
But I never liked T'Pol as a Vulcan.
No.
No.
I thought she was too, like, sort of came across as angry rather than stoic. And
I
don't know.
I also think they took too many liberties with her. Her being Vulcan, like, I think they kind of pushed her to be far too human.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, and even Tuvok, like, I felt like sometimes he came across as just kind of, like, annoyed rather than, which is an emotion very strongly, obviously. And Spock did that occasionally, but he was still kind of just, like, meh about it. And I don't know, I felt like Tuvok was kind of annoyed at everyone all the time.
You know, there's this great scene in Flashback where we see Tuvok on the Excelsior, and he's talking with one of his human compatriots, and he basically says the same thing what you're saying, Kayla. Like, Tuvok, you seem annoyed. And he's like, human beings always expect other races to share their same interests and their same sense of humor, and it's very arrogant of them, or something like that. And it's this really nice little critique of Starfleet's perfect humans that you didn't often see on Voyager. It actually kind of seemed like the kind of thing that you'd hear from Odo all the time on Deep Space Nine. And so it was really cool and refreshing to hear that in an appropriately Vulcan way from Tuvok on Voyager.
True. Although I would rebut with the fact that Vulcans shouldn't be showing annoyance particularly strongly.
In fact, in the very first scene of TOS, when they're playing chess, Kirk says that sometimes you can be irritating, Mr. Spock. And he says, irritation? Oh, yes, one of your Earth emotions.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Except that's the pilot, right?
That's
the way No Man Has Gone Before.
Yep, very first scene with both of our main characters. Oh, do we want to say anything about Seven? Kayla, what do you have to say about the Seven of Nine character?
So many things. It's kind of like you said earlier, Jared, that, you know, Seven of Nine shows up about halfway through the show and then very much takes over quite a bit of the story. There's a lot that has to do with the Borg in general. And, you know, she was, I think it's no secret that she was brought in to be, you know, for sex appeal.
Sure.
Most definitely.
The cat suit never bothered me that much. I guess I just accepted the fact that there was going to be one woman in a cat suit per series, and that was her. What did bother me was the fact that her heels were, like, part of the suit. They weren't separate. Her shoes were not separate. She was wearing high heels underneath the stretchy silver fabric. And I'm like, first of all, high heels, ridiculous.
Sure.
That's just completely stupid.
Yeah.
And it's like, she can't take them off ever.
I never noticed that.
Wasn't one of the reasons why, though, they had those heels in there was to make her that much taller and more imposing?
Yeah, maybe, but there are plenty of other ways to make someone look taller on television, like put them on a soapbox.
Yeah, they've been doing it with Tom Cruise.
No, I agree, but I always thought that that's why they did that. That's all.
I think they did it for sexiness. But
no, probably. Yeah, I look. I remember when they announced that character and they showed, you know, pictures of her and, you know, like TV Guide, whatever. I just rolled my eyes because it was like, at that point, everybody knew that Voyager was kind of struggling with its ratings, and it was such a clear like ploy to juice the ratings. But that being said, once you got to see the character and you saw where they were going to go with her, it didn't bother me as much. But totally. It was so obvious that they were trying to pander to, like, a teenage boy audience. It was so obvious.
And I shouldn't say, you know, I'm quick to say, oh, she was brought in for sex appeal. And, like, I agree with you, actually, that didn't end up bothering me so much. The little things, like her high heels, bother me, but that bothers me about every show that does that. But I really like the Seven of Nine character. I think she's an awesome character.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think Jeri Ryan is a great actress.
Oh, Jeri Ryan's amazing. And Seven of Nine ends up being, you know, potentially the strongest female character on the ship.
Agreed. I also, from, you know, last few times I've delved into Voyager and rewatched some episodes, one of the things that I appreciate about her is, you know, we always have the non-human character who is exploring humanity, Spock, Data, Odo, and or the Doctor to a lesser degree. And one thing that I really like about Seven is they are doing that, but it's not necessarily from that alien perspective. A lot of it is just, this is a person who grew up with a horrible trauma, and she's trying to reintegrate into society.
Definitely. It's like talking about people who have PTSD.
Yeah.
Or people who can relate to that. And that's pretty powerful. Pretty powerful message.
Yeah, and there's one episode where she's like trying to learn how to date, and it's just going disastrously for her. And you know, I think everybody, to one degree or another, very much like Spock, we all feel maybe like we're the odd man out. A lot of times we feel like we don't know socially how to interact, and everybody else around us does, and there may be something from our childhood that's dramatic that affected us that way, or maybe we're just a little shy or whatever. And I thought they handled it not just well, but gracefully, in a way that, with, you know, to return to the T'Pol character, because it's hard not to make a comparison, I don't think they handled things with her gracefully at all. I mean, like, there's one episode where she goes through Ponfar, which it's never been established that Vulcan females go through Ponfar, so it's kind of a continuity problem.
No, they do. No, they do.
Do they?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, they both get the call.
Okay.
At the same time.
Because in Star Trek III, I think Savick says it's just Vulcan males, but maybe I'm just...
Oh, yeah, I think you're right, but I think I want to... Then now we're probably going to get in trouble for this. Somebody's going to call us out. But I could have sworn in a mock time that Spock intimated that they both were going to get called
at that
specific time and that place, and that's what, you know, it was something that they were bonded in when they were children, and then at some point in their adult life they were going to have to heed the call.
Okay, I will defer to you or the internet that's the case. However, it wasn't my point I wanted to make is it wasn't handled gracefully on Enterprise. It was sort of handled up humorously, and you know, It seemed very tactless. Anyway, but the 7 of 9 character was not tactless. I thought she did an extremely good job to return to that.
No, to me, Seven's kind of like Spock, and she's kind of like Data in that she's, you know, the one who's trying to figure out who she really is.
Totally.
She's that character on Voyager.
Yeah, she is
she's
the Data
Spock character. She's the Data character, you know. And it's cool that they kind of, you know, she came onto the show later, and they kind of figured out a way to bring that angle to the show, because they didn't have a character like that up to that point.
Well, kind of the Doctor a little bit.
Yeah, kind of, but a lot of the Doctor was still being played for laughs, don't you think?
Oh, sure. Like, especially that episode where he makes the like his holographic 1950s family type of thing.
Right. yeah. That's right. I forgot about that. Anyway, we touched on something earlier that I want to get back to, and that is about Janeway and what a groundbreaking character she was, not only on Star Trek, but she was a groundbreaking character on TV at the time. Kate Mulgrew got to be the lead on an action-adventure TV series in the mid-90s. Now, there had been other women that had starred in action-adventure shows on TV, but during that time period, I don't think there were too many of them.
There still aren't too many of them.
No, but there.
I think
she was definitely separate. It was definitely unusual.
Yeah.
In 1995. So I wanted to talk a little bit about Janeway and her influence and what we think of her as a character, what we thought of Kate Mulgrew's performance as Catherine Janeway. So, Kayla, would you like to start?
Sure. I mean, I don't know that Janeway is my favorite captain. I think she's awesome as a captain. I actually really like Janeway as a captain. I know some people have problems with the way that her character was written. I've talked to some people who say that they didn't feel she was a strong female role, and they felt that the writers made her too emotional, which I agree with to some extent. I think at points in the show, they had her, you know, pining over her long-lost boyfriend in her ready room, and, you know, maybe that was showing a little bit, making her character appear a little bit too weak. But I like the idea of being able to humanize her as well, and the idea of saying, you know, just because you are being emotional about something and you happen to be a female, you know, the two aren't necessarily, one isn't causing the other.
Sure. I mean, the major defining character point of Sisko is that he misses his dead wife.
Yeah, no, it's true, actually. That's very true. So maybe it's okay then to do that, but I don't know. I guess there were times when I felt like she wasn't necessarily being the strongest woman character I'd ever seen. But I think overall, my opinion of that is that she was a strong female role. And she did, like, take charge very effectively. She didn't pull any punches. And when she was on the bridge, she wasn't, I don't think she necessarily based her command decisions in any other way compared to how a man might base his decisions. There was never any, like, oh, but I have to consider this factor because I need to, you know, appear like a mother to the crew. And I felt like they didn't do there's a couple episodes where they do like Janeway is kind of the mother of the crew, but I don't think that they belabor that point too much.
Yeah, but I don't think there's anything wrong with that either.
No, not at all.
Picard was the farther figure of the TNG cast.
Yeah.
And I think the captain, to some degree, is always going to be.
Yeah, but like, yeah. Picard was way more distant from the crew. So it's not until the final episode where he sits down and plays a game of cards with
them. That is true.
Which, incidentally, we didn't say this when we recorded the TNG episode, but that scene still gets me every time. That is a phenomenal way to send off that crew.
It was perfect. As far as show endings go, like I said earlier, you usually can't please everyone. I feel like the All Good Things did please everyone.
10 out of 10. 10 out of 10.
Yeah.
Bringing it back in.
But back to Janeway, yeah. I remember when I first started watching the show, her voice actually did put me off a bit just for the first couple of episodes.
Oh, yeah.
And I think one of my favorite...
Let's go, boys.
Yeah, one of my favorite... And Garrett Wong does an excellent Janeway impression if you've never seen him at conventions.
You know who else does is Claudia Christian, who played Ivanova on Babylon 5. I saw her at a convention where someone in the audience begged her to do her Janeway convention. And she said, no, I'm not going to do it. No, I'm not going to do it. And then she put her hands on her hips and said, let's go, boys.
I think one of my favorite tweets of all time was a tweet by Seth MacFarlane that something about him realizing that Captain Janeway sounds exactly like Cobra Commander.
Oh my God, she does.
Right? And to be fair, she tones it down a bit after the first season. But yeah, every time I watch the first season episodes, I just imagine Cobra Commander.
Yeah, I've always had a problem with the voice that she used for Janeway. It always kind of was nails on a chalkboard.
It did get better, though, right? Or is it just
it
me?
Did, I think it did, get it better. Did, but it was never great.
Is she trying to lower the timbre of her voice so she sounds more masculine to obviate some of the concerns that we've been discussing? Is that what she's doing?
I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm not sure what it achieves.
Hmm.
But it's funny you guys mentioned that, because that's always been like my major objection to watching Kate Mulgrew play Janeway was her voice.
Yeah. I think a lot of people, I remember introducing them to the show and they'd be like, but what's with her voice? And I'm like, no, it gets better. You get used to it. At this point, it doesn't bother me anymore. I kind of
well,
like
no,
her
of
voice.
Course not. But, yeah.
And maybe also because it does change as the seasons go on. But I remember definitely at first being like, what?
Interesting. Well, okay, there you go. Cobra Commander.
Cobra Commander.
Jared, do you have anything to speak about regarding Catherine Janeway?
Okay, so one thing I wanted to kind of address is sort of the broader topic of being a, quote, strong female character. I remember seeing an article, I don't know if it was in Wired or BuzzFeed or somewhere, about someone was complaining about the problems of always being so sensitive to making female characters quote unquote strong that they don't give them any nuance beyond that. And like there's so much effort to try to make sure that they are good role models from female, they're not anti-feminist and all these kind of things, and they don't get in trouble on Jezebel.com, that the female characters become very bland. And one thing I really liked about Janeway is she wasn't bland, right? She had her holodeck fantasies, just like Riker might. She had her addiction to coffee, just the way like Captain Picard enjoyed his tea, Earl Grey. And I'm sure I could think of some other things, but I appreciated that they didn't, in an effort to make her quote-unquote strong, they never made her bland.
Yeah, she was pretty three-dimensional.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
She was more than just a woman leading the ship. She actually was a character as well.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. One thing that, there's this online reviewer I really like. I actually interviewed him for one article on Trek Movie called SF Debris. And he had an idea for when he reviewed Caretaker for something that might have made Janeway a little bit more interesting, is to say that she's not the she wasn't the captain of Voyager when it got hurled into the Delta Quadrant, but she was actually the second or third officer, and the command crew got killed, and she kind of had command thrust on her afterward, and so that would have made her a little bit more have a little bit more to grow into the role. And we see that on Battlestar Galactica with President Roslin, where she's like the Secretary of Education, and then everybody gets wiped out, and she's kind of and gets put in charge. So maybe that was something that Ronald Moore thought about when he was preparing that character. But I thought that might have added a little bit more of a dynamic to Janeway, especially in the context of Chakotay. Like if it's technically her ship, but Chakotay actually has more command experience, that might have caused more headbutting between the two.
Interesting.
I don't know if that would have been better, but it's an interesting theory.
Should we move on?
Let's do it.
Let's do it. Okay, so, you know, clearly Voyager has its critics and it's also got its fans, and so I wanted to ask you guys what you feel are the show's virtues and what are its what detracts from the show.
I'll let Jared start out with this one so that I can respond.
Okay, so my... The thing that I kind of struggle with Voyager is the presence of the Maquis crew, because I always felt that the Maquis, there was enough material there for like a good half season's worth of Deep Space Nine, but there wasn't enough material there to draw out for seven seasons, especially when they're separated from the whole idea of what they're doing, which is fighting the Cardassians and whatnot. And so I thought it might have been more interesting if instead of the Maquis crew that Voyager gets... you know, was sort of forced to cooperate with, if it had been like an actually hostile race, like the Romulans or a group of, you know, Orion traders or whatever, or some other species that we've never heard of, because I think that would have, you know, made the conflict more in your face, I guess, if we could use that term. And also, mm-hmm. It wouldn't have been kind of shaving off just a part of another show and blowing it mm-hmm. up to 7 years when it didn't really deserve that.
Totally, and I don't disagree with that. I think the choice of the Maquis was, there was one reason to make that choice, and it was because they had been in Deep Space Nine, and they wanted to have some thread moving from one series to the other. And by the way, if you had never watched DS9 or hadn't followed it closely, and then started watching Voyager, you had no idea who these Maquis people were.
Oh, good point. I never thought of that.
I remember watching the first episode and thinking, they're not even introducing them. They're just like, oh, by the way, we're in the Badlands looking for the Maquis. And it was like, wait, what? And like you said, they were pulled. They were interesting because they weren't just bad guys, and they weren't just good guys. They were kind of somewhere like you were conflicted whether sure. or not you should be rooting for them.
Yeah.
But they were completely lost that element when they were in the Delta Quadrant, because the thing that made them conflicted and made you conflicted about them was back home in the Alpha Quadrant.
And the one part of that conflict that they carried over was the Seska character, who was just flat-out evil, right? I mean, so there was none of that moral ambiguity. I mean, of course, we don't want Seska to win. She's evil.
Right. What I think Voyager could have definitely done better is... I think that Voyager should have had an LGBT character. I think that all of the shows since then should have had an LGBT character. We still haven't had one. But the thing about... if it had come out in Voyager, with Voyager in 1995, I think that was the time when... the studios, and I believe that, I think it's true for several of the series, that that it's been proposed that we have an LGBT character, and the studio has said no. But in 1995, this is a time when the studio would have said no to that, and that the people making the show should have fought for it, like Gene Roddenberry fought for certain characters in TOS. Like, that's the point of Star Trek, is to be groundbreaking and do things that is going to make the studio fight you. And yeah. At this point, it's like I said, we still need an LGBT character, but at this point, it's too little too late to be, you know, groundbreaking in the way that TOS was in so many ways. So I think that's one of the biggest things they could have done.
Let me ask you a question. If the show had been syndicated instead of the flagship, no pun intended, of a new network, do you think that might have changed the perspective on that particular issue? And then it's kind of a broad issue that we could talk about other issues too.
You mean the studio would have changed the studio's response to that?
Yeah, if it had been syndicated and instead of responsible for anchoring a new network.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe, although I think they still would have had pushback at that time.
It was a different time.
Yeah.
It was a different time. It would have been quite an uphill battle. And when I interviewed David Gerrold last year for the site, we talked about the fact that Star Trek had never had any gay characters, and he basically felt that Rick Berman and Gene, to some degree, were protecting a very valuable investment, didn't want to offend anybody, and kind of just didn't really want to deal with that if they didn't have to.
That seems so not what Trek is about.
Yeah, but as when we discussed it, he basically said that, you know, Star Trek went from being this very, you know, progressive 1960s TV show to when it finally came back in the 80s and with Star Trek The Next Generation, it's no longer just this cute, progressive, you know, little watched network television show anymore. It's a multi-million dollar franchise, and it's worth a lot of money to Paramount. So they weren't going to rock the boat too much, lest they offend some of the audience.
Well, some people need to be offended.
No, I agree, but if you're in 19, especially with the AIDS epidemic and everything, you had all sorts of crazy ideas out there. They were going to try to avoid dealing with it if they weren't going to deal with it if they didn't, they weren't forced to, basically.
Sure, and I understand why they wouldn't want to, but again, I think that's like part of their duty to, if they want to make a Trek series, then like part of why we love it is because it pushes those kinds of boundaries and makes us think.
See, and I'm going to make a slight segue. One boundary that they pushed was with the and you can't see the quotation marks that I'm doing. It was with the Chakotay character, where they wanted to have like a main character who's an American Indian, which they'd also never done before. But he's this weird kind of non-Indian, where like he doesn't belong to a specific tribe, right? Like Scotty is not just, he's a European. No, he's from Scotland, right? But Chakotay is just an Indian. He's not a Navajo or whatever.
That's so true.
And that always struck me as just really weird. And I've wanted to ask Robert Beltran at a convention, but he's probably sick of hearing these kind of questions. Like, did he ever think, no, just make him a tribe, like whichever one it is, just pick one.
Yeah, it seems like kind of offensive to not, because then they made up like fake customs.
Yeah, they did. They did. And you know, if he's a Navajo, then there's all kinds of customs, very much like Scotty wearing a kilt or playing the bagpipe, that they can tie into as part of his cultural identity. And instead, it's just this weird, like, imaginary version of an Indian based on someone whose entire exposure to the culture is having seen Dances with Wolves.
Yeah, pretty much. That was kind of bad.
It's almost like they just said, okay, we need like an American Indian character here. And once they did it, they're like, okay, we could check that off now.
Yeah,
pretty much.
Yeah.
That's poorly handled.
And I actually, you know, I think the Chakotay character is pretty unremarkable, but I really like I really like Robert Beltran. I think he's got a nice sense of humor about the way he does everything. And he seems, you know, like a natural leader, or at least he did 20 years ago. And so I think that's kind of unfortunate with him. I don't know how much input he may have had on it, or he may have been like, you know, just starting out and figuring, you know what, my name is listed second on a major network show. I'm not going to rock the boat or the canoe, if you will. Okay.
No.
Sorry. All right.
That's right. He went there, ladies and gentlemen.
I did.
Should we move on to the next final thing?
Well, I was just going to throw my two cents in.
Sure.
In that I felt that the premise of the show was never sufficiently explored. Like, to me, if you're going to send a Starfleet vessel into the Delta Quadrant so far away from home where, you know, there's no star bases around, there are no Klingons, there's nobody that they can reach out to, that dynamic, the social dynamic, should have been explored more. What would happen to a group of people that far away from home with very little chance, as far as they knew, of ever getting back? Would you have massive morale breakdowns? Would you have, you know, you have the Maquis on board the ship. You've got basically these people who are not, you know, Starfleet officers per se, or traditional Starfleet officers, and you have to learn to live with these people. Like, to me, like, that a lot of that was never sufficiently explored. Like, when Voyager got home at the end of the show, that group should not have resembled in any way the group that left, because they didn't have Starfleet to anchor them anymore.
Yeah.
And I feel like they would have gone off in their own way that would have been completely independent from anything they'd ever done before. And I always felt like they didn't follow through on that. And that was one of the interesting – that to me, that was the intriguing premise behind Voyager was okay, we're going to see what's going to happen when you take these people away from the cozy world of Starfleet. But they never really did.
And instead, we got Battlestar Galactica, the reboot.
Right.
Which did that well.
It did. It did. So I guess I always was disappointed that they really didn't take the premise to what I would consider its natural conclusion.
Definitely.
I think if we want that premise to be well explored, there are just a handful of episodes that do it well. And it's unfortunate that there weren't major arcs. Like the one that's always cited is, and part of it was also the time it was on. I think if it was on nowadays, they would have been more ambitious. But there's like the Year of Hell story.
I really like Year of Hell, too.
Which is two episodes of Hell, whereas it should have been a year, right? They should have said this is season number four or whenever it was.
Yeah. Agreed.
Yeah, they didn't do that in those days. But you're right, Jared. That would have been a great, can you imagine? We'd be talking about that.
Oh, sure.
Like,
yeah. It would have.
Reverently.
I think it would have been the benchmark for the series. And you say they didn't do it back in those days. Well, Brian, on Deep Space Nine, they did it. It's called the Dominion War.
Yeah. No, that's true. That's true.
In terms of a couple episodes, if I can cite, that I think really, really do that extremely well, there's an episode called The Good Shepherd, where Janeway takes three, basically, misfits from her crew and goes on an away team with them. Because she realizes they're sort of the bottom rung. And one of the things they say is, if we were in the Alpha Quadrant, these people would have been dropped off at a star base years ago. But because we're out here, we need every hand we can get. These people haven't been. They haven't been washed out. And so I thought that was a good idea. That, you know, some of the characters we see who wouldn't have cut it or would have resigned from Starfleet, that here's their captain trying to take care of them. In particular, there's one character who, he says his whole reason he joined Starfleet is he thought it would look good on his application to grad school, and he was just going to do it for like a year and then go to grad school. And so I thought that episode, I don't know if the execution for that episode is great. I haven't seen it for a while. I don't know if you remember, Kayla.
Yeah.
And you have anything you want to say to it. But I thought that conceptually that episode was terrific.
I agree. I like when we get to see sort of the lower decks and like what is it, the people who are doing the dirty work, what do they look like?
Yeah.
But yeah, so we were going to talk about some of our favorite episodes, but ones that are more overlooked, like you just mentioned The Good Shepherd. So I had a few that I listed of my favorites that are ones that aren't always talked about as being great episodes. And my three are The 37s, which is the Amelia Earhart episode where they land on the, and you get to see the Voyager land on a planet, which is cool. And then, they find some, like, they find a 1936 Ford truck floating in space.
Uh-huh.
And then they find all of these people who disappeared from Earth in 1937, I guess. And, including Amelia Earhart. And it's like solving the mystery of whatever happened to Amelia Earhart. That's one of my favorite overlooked episodes. Blink of an Eye.
Oh, before you move on from the 37s, that's also like a longstanding TOS trope. Of explaining through our imaginary exploration of the galaxy some mystery from Earth.
Yeah, and I liked that. Thought that was fun. And it was, again, like, it was very much like a woman power episodes, like Janeway and Amelia Earhart, like, how awesome, like, what a cool, like, of anyone she could have met, that probably would have been one of her icons that she would have wanted to meet.
Blink of an Eye is great, Kel. I agree.
Yeah, Blink of an Eye is one of my favorite, if not my favorite, episode of Voyager, because it's just a really cool science fiction concept that did awesome. And it's obviously, the title is a nod to the TOS episode, Wink of an Eye. Yeah. And it's a similar concept where there's a planet that I think it has some gravitational anomaly around it that's causing the time on the planet to move super fast. And Voyager gets trapped in orbit because of this gravitational anomaly around this planet, and basically ends up inadvertently being a small part of this planet's history. Like, they see this thing in the sky when they're like a tribal people, and then they come to be, you know, not quite a warp civilization, but a spacefaring civilization, and they come and visit the Voyager, and the Voyager crew are moving, like, infinitesimally slowly.
Yeah.
And then they ended up sending the Doctor down because he's the only one who can survive the transition and yeah. lives on the planet for, like, I don't know, a year or two or something. He lives down there for quite a while, and it's a really great science fiction concept.
Yeah. And it talks about the idea of cultural contamination and...
Yeah.
You know, which is something that, you know, they had to deal with periodically on Star Trek because, you know, we could inadvertently with the Prime Directive, without using the Prime Directive, we could obviously contaminate cultures that were not ready for us, like who watches The Watchers and stuff like that.
And speaking of that, that leads me to one of the episodes I wanted to talk about called False Prophets, which is the Voyager crew happens upon a pair of Ferengi who have been exiled to the Delta Quadrant. And this was actually, this is a very unusual instance where we have a great Voyager episode that's a sequel to a mediocre TNG episode. and so typically I think Voyager is compared as, it's less favorable to TNG, but here's an episode where they just blow it out of the water. The idea is there's these Ferengi, they've found this primitive culture and they've taken it over, and they're using their advanced technology to portray themselves as deities and take advantage of these people. And Voyager comes and they say, well, you know, there's a debate about do we get involved or do we not get involved? And of course they do, because they need to save this culture from the Ferengi. But they have to do it in a way where they can't just use their technology and some technobabble to save the day. They need to use their wits to outwit the Ferengi. And this is an episode where Neelix is used extremely well, because Neelix is a traitor, so he understands, traitor with a D, not traitor, A-I-T-O-R, like Benedict Arnold, and he needs to go and negotiate with them, and so I think Neelix is used extremely well in this. Also, it's a nod to the first time Ethan Phillips appeared on Trek, it was as a Ferengi, so there's a nice little bit of continuity there. And I think of all the Voyager episodes, it's the one to me that feels most like a TOS episode, because it's this fun adventure where the Prime Directive is providing a framework for the action and the conflict, rather than the Prime Directive making them behave in a really weird way where they're not showing compassion when maybe they should, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I never thought of it being kind of like TOS, but you're right, Jared. It does have that kind of a vibe to it.
And I will point out the very punny title,
yes.
which is False Prophets, yeah. but it's spelled P-R-O-F-I-T-S, uh-huh. as in yep. profits, monetary profits.
Mm-hmm. Brilliant.
So clever. Oh, and before, just 2 seconds. In 2 seconds, I will summarize why I love the two-parter of The Killing Game, which is where the Hirogen, an alien race, basically takes over the Voyager and puts all of the Voyager crew in a holodeck simulation. And various simulations, and most of it takes place in World War II in France. But I will just say that I loved seeing Neelix playing a Klingon. That was one of the highlights of the series.
Oh, yeah. I got to check that out. Speaking of Klingons, my last episode I wanted to talk about is called Lineage. This is actually my favorite episode of Voyager. I think this should have been the if I could take any formula of an episode of Star Trek and say this is what you should be doing, it would be this episode. The idea is... B'Elanna is pregnant with with her and Tom's baby, and we see all these flashbacks from her back when she was a child, back in the Alpha Quadrant, of growing up, and her father, who was human, disapproving of the parts of her that were Klingon, which is maybe like some of his unresolved issues toward B'Elanna's mother, who was full Klingon. And so B'Elanna wants to genetically modify her baby so she's 100% human. And so the thing I love about this is we have a very... realistic, plausible, everyday kind of human conflict, which is the concerns that things that we like about ourselves, we want to pass on to our children, things we don't like about ourselves, we don't want to pass on to our children, against the context of a science fiction resolution to that problem. And there's this very believable conflict among the characters, which we talked about in the TNG episode, that there wasn't enough conflict there. where Tom loves B'Elanna and he doesn't want his daughter to be less like her. He doesn't want her to be monkeyed with. And the Doctor, he's ethically programmed that he can't monkey with someone's genes at all. And so it's this great three-way conflict between these, or among these characters. I think there's a lot of heart in that episode. And the whole idea of the flashbacks to B'Elanna when she was a child, what it reminds me of actually is like episodes of Lost, where they'd show flashbacks of what people were like back on the mainland, and then that would be contrasted to what was happening on the island that week. And I think if there were more episodes like this of Voyager, I think it'd have a better legacy. I think I'm the only one who talks a lot about this episode, but I just love it. I would like to hang a lantern on it, to use Kayla's phrase.
Excellent. I'm going to have to go back and rewatch all three of those episodes, Lineage, Good Shepherd, and False Prophets, because I haven't seen them in ages.
Oh, excellent. Thank God for Netflix, I guess.
Yeah, seriously. Oh, and, you know, maybe I said this to you guys before, maybe this is something everyone just sort of already agrees with, but the reinvigoration of the Star Trek franchise in the last few years, I think, has far less to do with New Trek and way more to do with Netflix, because now everybody can watch so much of the franchise and stuff they've never seen before so easily.
Yeah, but New Trek has inspired a lot of people to say, I'm going to go watch the original series, sure, which I've never seen.
Yeah, it certainly helps that people have both.
Yeah. Well, why don't we wrap up the episode? I know it's gone kind of long here, but how do you pack 7 years of an entire series into less than an hour?
You'd have to be accelerated past the point of normal human time perception. Just like the Doctor in Blink of an Eye.
Just like Blink of an Eye. Unfortunately, we weren't able to do a Blink of an Eye episode, which would have lasted about 0.3 seconds.
Yeah. But we'll see you in 2 weeks.
There it is.
Yeah.
That was it. But, Jared, I heard that you have another Trek anecdote
yes,
for us.
Yes, I do. So we want to try to end every episode with an anecdote about Star Trek from how it touches our life. It has touched our life in, like, a fun or amusing everyday way. If you have Trek anecdotes you want to share with us, put them in the comment section or tweet them at us at TrekMovie. And we'll hope we'll be able to share some of those in future episodes. But the one that I wanted to share, this is another work-related Trek anecdote where sometimes, you know, when my last job I had, things would get a little bit busier than other times, and so we'd have to really step it up. And I was sick of cliches like step it up or take it to the next level. So I started saying, we need to go into multi-vector assault mode, which is, yeah. Oh, I'm glad you liked that one. That's referencing I believe it's called Ship in a Bottle episode, where the Doctor goes back and he's on board the Prometheus and he meets Andy Dick, and the ship can separate into three different parts. And there's this fight with this Romulan ship, and it goes into multi-vector assault mode. And we can be sure to include the clip up from YouTube on the site. And I used it so much that one of my coworkers started referring to MVAM sessions. Like, we need to have an MVAM session tomorrow, Jared. Because MVAM, of course, is the acronym for multi-vector assault mode.
Amazing. Has he ever seen the episode?
I've never told her about this. I've never told her. Awesome. I've sort of just kind of kept it to myself.
So she doesn't know it's Star Trek.
No, she doesn't. She doesn't. Also, we were supposed to, we didn't have offices, and so we had these little offices at the side that we'd go into, and we just had a cube farm otherwise. And so I started referring to them as collaboration booths, which was because we said collaborate all the time at this place. And that was, of course, a little sly reference to the agony booth from Mirror Mirror.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Excellent. Well, before we go, I wanted to give a little shout out to, like, the coolest Trek thing that I've seen on the web recently, which is a Jean-Luc Picard-inspired beer called Make It So. It's by Summit Brewing Company. It's an extra special, extra strong bitter, and it's part of their Unchained series, number 19, Make It So. And it is actually brewed with Earl Grey tea in it. Mm. And I haven't tried it. I want to try to get my hands on it. It's got pretty good, it's got a, on the Beer Advocate website, it's got a very good rating of 88 points out of 100, and then people who are commenting on the website are giving it a 91 out of 100.
Wow.
So it sounds like it's pretty good beer. I would definitely try it. Although I've tried making things with Earl Grey tea before and it hasn't worked out. But yeah, I'd try it.
But kudos to you for your effort.
Maybe during the next podcast, we can all record and pair the recording with a drink. And if we talk about Picard, we can pair it with the Make It So beer.
Wow. You know, see if we can dig it up. And if anybody listening has had it, please feel free to leave a comment and let us know how it was.
And if the people who make the Make It So beer would like to subsidize an episode of the pod, of the Shuttle Pod, we're open to that as well.
I would not be opposed to that.
Yeah, no, no, please. We like free beer.
Oh, I meant money, but, you know, it goes either way.
Oh,
well. I mean, in the future, we've grown beyond money. Never mind.
Of course, yeah. Of course. We're beyond such material pursuits, right? Right, right. Anywho, I think it's about time to wrap it up. What do you guys think?
Yep.
Yeah, great episode. So we could talk about this for about 8 more hours, but I think we should spare the audience.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, talking about the entire run of 7-year run of a television show, can you're covering a lot of ground.
So. Yeah.
Alrighty. All right, so I guess we should wrap up.
Okay, thanks, everybody.
Yeah, thank you for listening. As always, please leave comments and, you know, story. We need ideas for the podcast, so if you have anything you want to hear us talk about, please, you know, do
get
that.
Get in touch. Get in touch. Tweet us at Trek Movie. Find us on Facebook, and obviously you can reach us through the comments section on the website.
Yeah, please. More feedback, the better. Anyway, this is Brian and Kayla and Jared, and we'll talk to you soon.
Okay, thanks, everybody.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.
Hashtag LLIP.